Hey everyone, Cave Dan here for the Faithless Brewing Podcast. This episode is part two of our doubleheader week. Part one has already been posted. It is a deep dive into the brand new Pioneer format. We talk mana bases, removal options, the top strategies, and how to prepare against them. If you are interested in learning about how to brew decks in Pioneer, be sure to go back and check it out. And after that, come back and listen to this episode for some modern content. We've got spicy decks from SCG Regionals, testing results with the Great Henge, and other new trends in the modern format. But before we jump into that, I have news that I am very excited to share with our listeners. After many months, we are finally launching our Patreon page. If you are not familiar with Patreon, it is a way for fans to contribute directly to creators they would like to support. Now, we realize that not everyone is in a position to support us financially, and that is perfectly okay. Our show will always be free, that's not going to change, and we continue to be grateful for the many ways that our listeners support us, whether that's giving us feedback, leaving us a review on iTunes, or just telling a friend and saying, hey, here's a podcast you might like. But enough of you have asked us over these past 26 odd weeks and said, hey, we'd like to support the show, that we've decided the time is right for a Patreon launch. So, if you are interested, you can head over right now to patreon.com/faithlessbrewing for all the details on how to become a patron of the show. We've been working hard on creating a number of different tiers and benefits as a way of saying thank you to our listeners. We have goals set up to get some cool merchandise and swag sent out, if that's your thing. You'll get access to our Faithless Brewing Discord channel, which we are really excited about launching. We hope that can be a place where listeners can interact with us, ask questions, and talk about Magic the Gathering, not just with us, but with a community of other passionate and creative brewers who make up the listener base of our show. We also have some practical goals that will help us to produce a better podcast. We would love to get new audio equipment and hire a production editor. These are all things that your support can help make possible. So if you are a fan of the content we produce, if you feel like this show provides some value to you, some entertainment or some inspiration, and you'd like to give back while also receiving cool rewards, please head over to patreon.com/faithlessbrewing and check it out. We're going to be talking more about this in the next few weeks because we really want to get this off the ground and we are excited to start growing our community of brewers over in the Faithless Brewing Discord. So stay tuned for that, or brace yourself for that, as the case may be. In the meantime, thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 26 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson. I want to give a quick shout out at the top of the show here to my sister, Maya. Happy birthday, number 31. She claims to be our biggest fan in Finland. So if there's any Finns out there that would like to challenge her for that throne, this is your chance. Now that we got that out of the way, I am joined as always by my guy on the West Coast. He is Nuke Launch Online. He is fresh off of a top eight at an MCQ. Damon Alexander. Damon, what's good?
Oh, happy birthday to Maya as well. Things are good in Seattle. It's been a pretty gray October, but I can't complain too much. Dan and I are going to GP Columbus, which we're excited about. And yeah, I managed to top eight a standard PTQ.
Yeah, so we're going to hear all about that. First, we want to introduce the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. He also is Cave Den Online and manages our Twitter account at FaithlessMTG, Dan Schriever. Dan, what's good, buddy?
Hey, gentlemen, how are you? Happy birthday, Maya, and anyone else out there who's having a birthday right now, whether you are in Finland or anywhere else. Yeah, this ended up being just a crazy couple of days. I had penciled this in as a quiet week. Maybe we'll spend some time on some off-the-beaten-path modern cards or something, and then just all of a sudden, since this announcement on Monday morning, everything's been spinning. It's been crazy.
What Dan is alluding to is the creation of a new format, Pioneer. We are going to delve into that a little bit deeper today as sort of our exploration of the week is some basics of the format, how we want to think about it, weaknesses, strengths, etc. But before we get too deep into that, we kind of want to do a weekend roundup of results in Standard and Modern. So let's start with you, Damon. You top aided a PTQ in your local gaming shop. Is that correct?
Yeah. The schedule for the PTQs this fall seems to be mostly Standard. And I'm not really a Standard player, but PTQs are always a good time. And I do have this dream of maybe one day making the Pro Tour ever since I was a child. And we got second place at a PTQ. Team Sealed. I didn't put too much prep into it, and so what I did is they released the MC5 deck lists, and I was like, well, I mean, maybe people are iterating on Standard between the release of those in this tournament, but this list that the Czech testing house released looks pretty sweet, called Bant Ramp, which is different than Bant Food for all of you people who don't understand the Standard deck naming. Basically, what drew me towards it is that this is a 4 Oko deck.
Oh, yeah.
And even after our Oko week, I just don't get that card. Even after this tournament, I still don't understand Oko at all. I'll just get some practice running out the 4 Gilded Goose, 4 Oko. The deck's basically dream is to play either turn 2 Oko or turn 3 Nissa Who Shakes the World. Unfortunately, my idol Martin Yuza only went 6-6 at the Mythic Championship 5, but I managed to go 5-0 in the Swiss, and then I lost in the quarterfinals to the terror of Standard called Bant Golos. So terrifying I got banned.
Yeah, I mean, you have Okos in your deck. I think it's a given you were going to go 5-0. That's pretty much, I think we've established that.
Exactly.
Ample evidence suggests that if you put Oko in the main deck, whatever format you're playing, 5-0, no trouble.
So we're not much of a Standard podcast, Damon, but just summarize your impressions of the Standard as a format, your experience playing it, maybe because you're playing such powerful cards in Standard, you know, as this new set is really up there in power level. Maybe it even felt like Modern in some respects. Or no, you kind of had to learn a whole new different sort of conceptualized play patterns.
As weird as this sounds, it felt more like EDH than other competitive formats. Because the best two decks really seem to be these kind of like food decks featuring a bunch of planeswalkers and a bunch of ramp. And then these Golos decks, which feature literally the card that looked like a commander card, Kenrith the Returned King. Just like a bunch of haymakers. I mean, this deck plays 2 Agent of Treachery, 5 blue-blue. Steal somebody's permanent as a 2/3 main deck. Apparently really good against the field. One of the better decks from the MC was running 4 Disdainful Stroke main, and like that's a commander card at heart. Meant for Battlecruiser Magic interaction. It was a very strange tournament. Every so often somebody would try to kill you with like a quick Ember Cleave, double striking knight or something. At one point somebody just dumped 6 creatures in the battlefield by turn 3, and I looked at my deck and I was like, I don't have any sweepers. This game's over. But it was pretty fun. I think that if you play against Bant Golos a lot, you will start to slowly hate your life. But that's why they banned it. And I think if you play for a while, you'll also get really sick of Veil of Summer and Teferi. Also equally warping effect on the format, which I can understand. Those are powerful cards.
Yeah, those are the best cards available in Modern for that kind of effect. I can only imagine in Standard how they must outclass a lot of the other fun cards you could open up in a booster of the latest set.
Yeah, apparently, like, Control is dead, not just because Bant Golos has inevitability, but also because Teferi just will absolutely wreck Control decks, and it's played a lot.
I want to ask you about one card in particular, and that is the card Wicked Wolf.
Yeah.
2 green-green for a 3/3 wolf. When it ETBs, it fights up to 1 target creature your opponent controls, is that right?
Yep, and it has this ability to sack a food to give it a +1/+1 counter, and the new form of regeneration where it gets indestructible and taps.
So what's the deal with this card? In the little Standard that I've seen, it looked very good. I think you mentioned to me that it was one of your better cards on the day.
Yeah, what happened is there's a Simic food deck that a lot of the other pros were playing that played 4 Wicked Wolf main deck. And I saw the Friday coverage and I was like, man, maybe I should be running some of these main deck. Ah, no, I'll trust the Czech testing house. And then I lost a lot of game ones and then I just sided into my Wicked Wolves and then they just took over games. I don't know about this card in the Eternal formats, like if it's playable, but the way you can think of it, it's like a Chupacabra-type card with massive upside. If you have an Oko or even just a Gilded Goose and a Wicked Wolf out, Wicked Wolf just becomes this indestructible, slowly growing card that is very hard to stop. It's also a bad target for bounce effects or for Deputy of Attention, because then it could threaten to come back and fight again.
So you anticipated my question then. Is it possible that this card is a contender in Modern? We've already seen that Oko is quite strong, and even Gilded Goose, as someone on this podcast, it wasn't me, but someone on this podcast,
it wasn't me either,
predicted that Gilded Goose was going to become a format staple in Modern. Lo, it has come to pass. I've been playing against so many Gilded Gooses. Gilded Geese?
Geese.
Yes. A whole gaggle of geese online in Modern. We've talked often about how there's no Flametongue Khaivu in Modern. Wicked Wolf, like you're saying, can be that, or it could be more, depending on the board state, or less.
Yeah, unfortunately it doesn't work with Kiora. That's still sad. But it's definitely a good card. One thing I learned about this deck that took a while to digest is that everything is kind of built around 3/3s. Between the Oko and the Nissa, all these cards that do well against 3/3s are really good. No matter what creature your opponent plays, you've got these four Okos, you can make anything a 3/3. Oko really kind of brings down your opponent's level into 3/3 Elk. And so if your main deck can handle 3/3 Elk, you're going to have a great time. Wicked Wolf, guess what? It preys on Elk. No problem. Nissa makes 3/3s, they can trade with Elk, no problem. Tolsimir, Friend to Wolves, well, this card also is really good at fighting 3/3s, or fighting their smaller creatures and leaving you 3/3s that can beat their Elk in combat. Whether this theory of 3/3 battle and downgrading translates to Modern super well, I don't know for sure, but I mean, for example, in Niv-Mizzet, which features a pile of Lightning Helixes, I'm wondering if the correct number of Okos is more than one for this reason.
I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but that makes perfect sense. That's very helpful.
That's why I think people are getting really fed up with Oko. Anything cool you could ever do in your Magic deck, it's an Elk. Do all this work to resolve a great hand, you're like, man, I finally, you know, worked really hard to develop a plan. I've talked with my friends over our podcast for hours about how to make the Great Henge happen in Modern. Great Elk.
I think what Ari Lacks very aptly described it as is it basically reads that any creature with cost of three or more, it means that their text doesn't matter.
Right.
We'll get into this in Pioneer, because this is one of my big theories about the format. That has a warping effect on some of the choices you should make with your deck building. And obviously, Standard is a much smaller format than Modern or Pioneer. So, but still a great result. Will you be playing any more Standard, Damon, or just as MCQs present themselves?
I mean, honestly, I bought these Okos at like $30 each, and now they're worth way more. And I have what became a pretty expensive pile of cards. It was a fun deck. GP Portland in December is Standard. And if there's any PTQs near me in the future, I don't think there are, I would be interested in playing them. One thing, honestly, that Faithless Brewing has taught me how to do pretty well is take a pile of cards that you've never played with before, show up in a league and 5-0 with it, or maybe 2-3 with it, has happened to me this week.
That's what it's all about. I mean, that's that's why we do what we do.
Yeah.
Congrats on the result. That's an amazing finish.
Yeah, definitely. So turning our eyes to Modern results, there was a bunch of SCG regionals. It was at 10 different events. And then there was an MTGO PTQ, all in Modern. Did you guys see any lists that were kind of interesting or technology that you want to take note of?
There were a couple lists in particular that just caught my eye. As you said, the Star City Games regionals happen in like 10 or 12 cities. So there's like a massive pile of top 8 lists. There were also the usual tournaments on Magic Online. Tons of results to sift through, almost like too much to really digest. But the one deck that, when I saw it, made me think, oh no, this is the Team Lotus Box Oko Urza Goose deck. Damon, you mentioned this last week. Having seen it a little bit more of it in action, I am terrified of this deck. So the deck list, it's 4 Gilded Goose, 4 Urza, 4 Oko, 4 Emery. If I told you that the deck was going to have those cards in it, you'd be like, oh, well, it's got the artifact package. It's got Opals, Astrolabes, Mistress Baubles, 4 Engineered Explosives. And there's no combo finish. There's no Paradoxical Outcome or Jeskai Ascendancy. Instead, they just play some counter spells. 3 Cryptic Commands, 2 Metallic Rebuke. And it has Fetch Lands and Mystic Sanctuaries to rebuy the Cryptic Command. Zan Syed, who's the captain and kind of the mastermind of Team Lotus Box, fantastic player. Won his regionals in Raleigh-Durham with this list. It also made top eight in, I want to say, the format challenge. What do you guys think of this list?
It doesn't have an explicit combo finish, but if you watch it in action, it actually kind of does have a pseudo combo finish. What happens is when you get Gilded Goose plus Urza plus Tracker out, you generate so many artifacts so quickly that you generate so many Urza draws so quickly that you give you more mana to find more cards or honestly just activate your Gilded Geese. I was playing as this deck and all of a sudden they have like 6 food in play and that's 6 Mox Sapphires and also 18 life. And it was clear that every turn from there they were going to use their 2 Geese to generate more life, and because they had a bunch of Astrolabes and food with Urza out, they generate even more mana. They're not short on that. They can start looping Cryptic Commands or just take over the board with Trackers or the Karn Structs, etc., while simultaneously using the Emra EE line to tactically nuke whatever problematic permanents you've developed. And so in that sense, it really does kind of combo off where it has one or two turns that are so big that you just lose.
I think what Damon says is exactly right. It doesn't have that one combo finish where you're taking like millions of game actions, but over the course of the key turn, you know, 3, 4, 5, the game is functionally over. They can close a game quite quickly because the construct they're making eventually becomes the Abyss. And if they get to cast multiple Engineered Explosives, you don't necessarily have blockers.
They have 3 Cryptic Commands. They can take lines, tap your team, attack with a giant construct.
One of the things I really like is that they picked a counterspell that Urza can hit and it still does something. So if Urza flips up Cryptic Command, it's not like Metallic Rebuke where it's a dead card. They can still bounce and tap. And they do have a soft lock with that Mystic Sanctuary with a Tireless Tracker and the ability to draw. You can Cryptic Command every turn for the rest of the game.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it can go along very comfortably.
I didn't even think of that. When I look at this list, it's just all good cards. Overpowered cards.
Not only are they really good cards individually, the cards just work super well together. This list is strong. I watched them play some games with it. I love Niv-Mizzet, but part of me wonders if I should be looking at picking up some Mox Opals in the near future.
They dodged a ban on Monday, so yeah, I guess. Coast is clear.
They're only $100 each. Easier said than done.
So this list has 15 cards from Eldraine in the 75, and then another 10 from Horizons. The shape of Modern has just really changed. The power points in the format have really shifted a lot with these latest releases.
Yeah, for better or for worse, the last 4 sets have obsoleted entire strategies, and even with the unbanning of Stoneforge, have pushed out a bunch of cards that we would consider to be sort of pillars of the format in short order.
Yeah.
Mox, Opal, Cryptic, EE, I guess the Baubles, and then like Tracker, everything else is new.
So kudos to Lotus Box and Zanslayad for the finish. Another deck that, when I saw this, I was like, yes, that's it. This deck is great. Comes from Aspiring Spike. Who else but Aspiring Spike? He has become, I think, one of my favorite brewers to follow. He's always playing something interesting. He's, I think, 2nd on the leaderboard right now on Magic Online. This is a Simic Eldrazi deck. So Eldrazi deck, you're thinking Eldrazi Temple, Thought Not Seer, Reality Smasher. When you add green to that, that usually means Noble Hierarch and Ancient Stirrings, which is a fantastic card for finding either the temple or one of your big Eldrazi creatures. But what this deck does really, really well is it uses the card Once Upon a Time, which we talked about. What's the best home for Once Upon a Time? Amulet has made great use of it. We're seeing it pop up in Death Shadow lists. One of the best things you can do with Once Upon a Time is find an Eldrazi temple. That kind of locks in your value. If you're grabbing a soul land, the land that taps for 2 off of this, you lock in a tempo boost that is really hard for them to interact with. So by adding 3 Once Upon a Time to this Eldrazi core, you have the beginnings of something really strong. Pairing this green Eldrazi core with blue gives access to 2 really exciting cards. One is Oko. You have green mana, you have blue mana, you should probably play some Okos. The second one is Elder Deep Fiend. Do you guys remember this card?
Yes.
Wait, I thought you were going to say Eldrazi Sky Spawner. It's in the list.
It is in the list. I've had to dig through many a common bin looking for Eldrazi Sky Spawners back when I was trying to play Bant Eldrazi. This is like Bant Eldrazi on steroids, and the Elder Deep Fiend finish is really, really clever. Elder Deep Fiend uses the Emerge mechanic, which means that you can pay it for a reduced cost by sacrificing a smaller creature, then the Elder Deep Fiend will emerge, like alien or something, from the belly of the small creature. And you'll get it for I don't know, 3-4 mana. But because its converted mana cost is 8, it is capable of triggering the card Sanctum of Ugin, which is a land that taps for colorless, usually seen in traditional Tron decks. But if you cast an Elder Deep Fiend and you have a Sanctum of Ugin in play, you can then trigger the Sanctum, sacrifice it to find another Elder Deep Fiend. The cast trigger on this card is essentially a Mistbind Click / Cryptic Command hybrid. It taps down up to 4 permanents, which can tap all their mana, can tap their creatures, whatever you need. So the deck can top out on this Elder Deep Fiend sequence. Anytime I've had that in a deck, it's really overperformed, and I'm very excited to see it here. So I think Aspiring Spike had a couple of 5-0s with this list. He also took it to his Paper Regionals event, and I think he went 7-2. Another player, CEL, then played it in the Sunday PTQ on Magic Online, and I think made top 4. I think this deck looks really cleverly built.
Yeah, it really showcases the power of Once Upon a Time. This card is, having played with him more, this card is really good. The fact that you can now keep a 2-land hand and just trust that your Once Upon a Time will find you a third land. Not just a third land, but also a third land that, like, usually you can find the right color you need. 5 cards is pretty deep. And then if you have a land-heavy hand or draw, this will then dig you towards your better creatures. And again, 5 cards is a pretty long way to look.
Yeah, absolutely.
Playing against these Eldrazi decks, sometimes I always feel like, man, the games where they draw multiple Thoughtknot Seers are just so hard to win. Or Smashers. With 4 Once Upon a Time, they will have multiple Thoughtknot Seers and Smashers way more often than they won't.
Yeah, and I think this deck does a good job, because it has mana creatures, of mitigating the bad version of Once Upon a Time. Because 2 mana search your top 5 is probably not quite good enough. But the first one being free is miserable design, in my opinion, but it is what it is. But when they cast a quote-unquote fixed version, the non-broken version, they just have mana lying around. They have Eldrazi Skyspawner tokens. They have mana creatures. It's not that big of a deal for them to cast it when they need to.
This deck also features the Thoughtknot Seer Oko synergy. If you need to make the Thoughtknot Seer into an elk, you will prevent your opponent from drawing a card. Just when you thought there were no more annoying Oko synergies.
It's very, very relevant, because often the Thoughtknot Seer is the creature you're going to want Elder Deep Fiend. So you eliminate that ability. It keeps its casting cost. So you get to Elder Deep Fiend for 3 in their upkeep as an example, and they don't get to draw.
Great point.
Yeah, and meanwhile, Thoughtknot Seer on its own stacks up favorably if you're elkifying the opposing permanents.
True. True. So kudos to Aspiring Spike for another great list. This is one I'm excited to try myself. The last list that I wanted to just give a quick shout out to from regionals is from the Knoxville regional. This is 5-color Niv-Mizzet featuring a full playset of Gilded Goose as the 1-mana accelerator of choice. This deck finished in first place in the regionals, so Niv-Mizzet is now a SCG regional champion in addition to the other accolades we've been tracking over these months. Great job to Cameron Martinez for the finish. What do you guys think of this build with all of the food?
4 Goose seems crazy to me.
It is crazy, but it's got 2 Oko, so it can't be that wrong. I mean, that card is just great. 2 Oko, 2 Ren and 6, 3 Teferi. The rest of the deck looks pretty similar to what we play.
I like the 2 Oko. I found 4 Geese to be pretty hungry to eating food. I guess my default would be to play 3 Geese and a Bird, or 2 and 2. Or 2 Geese and 2 Utopia Sprawl or something. But maybe the Goose creating food to fight off Burn came up more than you'd think.
Yeah, on the other hand, I mean, I always felt like the Burn matchup actually felt pretty solid between the Helixes and the Kaya's Guiles. It's Holsimir and the Huntmaster.
That was always my sense, too. That's why I don't think you need the full 4 Geese, but it's maybe worth trying. I played 4 Geese and a bunch of those Sultai Ninja Shells, and I think I cut down to 3 Geese and 2 Birds of Paradise by the end, because the geese do just start absorbing a lot of your food. And a lot of times you want, especially in Niv-Mizzet, it's a very mana-hungry deck. So when you resolve Niv-Mizzet, now your hand's full of all these spells and you want to cast them. So if you don't have food after that, that's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, they're very good at getting you the 1-3 skip, but then you kind of suffer from the 3-4 slip sometimes.
Oh, we got to make that a more catchy phrase. So speaking of Niv-Mizzet, Dave, you were tinkering around with some builds yourself. Do you want to tell us about the list you were trying?
Yeah, so I kind of like jokingly proposed a build with 4 Fabro Elder during Oko week. And literally right after the podcast ended, Damon just took it into a league and 5-0'd with it. So it's either a credit to Damon's ability to play Niv-Mizzet as someone who's, you know, gone through the, he's been in the trenches with this deck for a long time. But I was just stunned by how effective it was, because I think all the criticisms that you guys were sort of lobbying were pretty legit, that the card makes you very vulnerable to removal and you have to play some weird cards to try to take advantage of it because you need permanence in play to really turn it on. And it's kind of a win more card, right? When you resolve Niv-Mizzet, now your favorite Burrow Elder is this huge beater that can also help you cast your hand quickly. So, encouraged by Damon's results, I think someone jokingly suggested, well, you know, if we played more like blue-red permanents, we were considering playing Royal Scions. I think there was a one of in that list, and Royal Scions, after you play Fabro Elder, is very powerful. But they were like, oh, if you play Saheeli Rai, you actually get to attack with two Fabro Elders, and they're both 4-4. Then they can tap after combat. So that interaction, I thought, was really interesting, because it lets you ramp while expanding your board, and it gives you a lot of outs to turn 3, win the game. Fabro Elder into Saheeli Rai is actually a ritual that turn, because the new Fabro Elder taps for 4 and Saheeli Rai only costs 3 to play. You actually have access to up to 9 mana if you don't do anything else. That's more than enough to bring to light. And even if you don't have your 5th color, you only need to bring to light for 4 to get your Felidar Guardian.
Can you walk me through that turn sequence?
Sure. So it's Magical Christmas Land. So we turn 1 Utopia Sprawl, turn 2 cast Fabro Elder. So right now, Fabro Elder is a 2-2 Vigilance because there's only green and white permanents in play. On our turn 3, we don't need to play a land, but let's just say that we do. So we've got 4 mana in our lands. We tap 3 of them and play Saheeli Rai. She targets the Fabro Elder with her -2 ability, so she creates a token that's a copy of it, and it has haste. So now we have 2 Fabro Elders, and they see themselves, which are green and white, and Saheeli Rai, who is blue and red. So they're each 4-4, and they each tap for those 4 colors. Obviously, you could attack for 8, that's fine, but what if you wanted to tap them for 8 mana total? If you have a Bring to Light in your hand, you can cast it, and it will go find you Felidar Guardian. And the Felidar Guardian Saheeli Rai combo is known. It was banned in Standard. There's been certain shells that have used it in Modern even, because it is quite powerful. It's called Copycat sometimes.
Yeah, if you thought attacking for 8 was cool, how about attacking for a billion?
Yeah. Felidar Guardian keeps blinking your Saheeli Rai, resetting her to 3 loyalty, then she -2s to copy the Felidar Guardian, etc., etc. So you make an infinite amount of 1-4 Felidar Guardians. And the list felt great. That combo came up all the time. I don't think I won a fair way, or maybe once, where I like Saheeli Rai to copy some beaters or whatever. The interaction I really loved is because, again, I was playing Fabro Elder, I was playing 4 Tide Hollow Sculler. The Tide Hollow Sculler into Oko opening line is also incredibly good, especially against unfair decks. Similar to what you're describing with the Thought Knot Seer, Tide Hollow Sculler has a come into play ability that removes a card from the opponent's hand, and it has a separate ability when it leaves play to return that card to their hand. If you turn 2 Tide Hollow Sculler, you take their removal spell. This happened quite a bit. Turn 3, Oko, make it a elk, and they never get their card back. Taking that removal is very relevant because there's only so many pieces of instant speed removal a deck has, and only certain pieces of removal are relevant against the Felidar Guardian Saheeli Rai combo. Once you do that a few times, they have to interact with your board. Your board's very powerful. You have Oko and an elk that's grazing in the wilderness. And now it sort of sets them up to lose your combo once they start having to interact with what you've already played to the board. That interaction came up all the time. So, yeah, I went 4-1. I lost to some really awkward draws. I think I double mulliganed and triple mulliganed. And I had outs in each of those games. And my opponent played very well, I have to say. Shoutouts to him. Yeah, the deck felt really good. I'm kind of interested in tweaking it a little bit, upping my Oko count because the card is broken, and trying to see if there's maybe something here.
One question I have is, do you need the Niv-Mizzet? Did you go for Niv-Mizzet lines very often?
Yes, against decks where they had mana up and I didn't want to go for it. I did, and it was relevant quite a bit, actually, like against Jund.
Yeah.
You guys have talked about it over and over again. You guys have been beating the crap out of these kids trying to play Jund for the last half a year. The one Niv-Mizzet is actually really relevant in that case. It also, they bring in lots of spells that negate like effects. So if you draw your Niv-Mizzet, which is very possible, if you are blinking your Oath of Nissa, etc., you see a lot of cards in your deck. Just resolving Niv-Mizzet against those kind of cards is great. They've got their Force of Negation or something, and you just resolve this threat that functionally wins the game. And most people actually they're just throwing down to a resolved Niv-Mizzet at times. Also, if you want to, I gave my Niv-Mizzet pseudo-haste by casting Niv-Mizzet with Saheeli Rai in play, drawing a bunch of cards, then -2, copy Niv-Mizzet, sack the creature with sickness, get the hasting to visit, attack for 6, and eventually you have to discard a hand size if your opponent hasn't thrown down yet. So
those lands are dangerous. Sometimes, actually, one thing I win playing Niv-Mizzet is you only have 3 good Niv hits in the deck before you just run out of spells.
Yeah, in this case, I think it was actually for lethal. The 6 damage haste was enough to kill them. That's a play you can make if you want to. Another thing that came up that I didn't know, so I would have maybe even won one of these games if I knew this. Once a Tide Hollow Sculler is an elk, if you copy it with Saheeli Rai, you get a Tide Hollow Sculler token.
Right, it has the abilities of the original.
Yeah, so an opening you can, if you were an idiot like I am, you could have done in some of these games was Tide Hollow Sculler on 2, Oko on 3, make it an elk, attack them for 3. They do, you know, whatever, play their Tarmogoyf. You play Saheeli Rai, copy the Sculler, take another card from them, turn it into an elk, so it's gone permanently. The elk still gets sacrificed, which is fine, but they don't get that card back. So Saheeli Rai, like, functionally minus 2s to do 2 damage to them and exile a card permanently.
3 damage because it's a hasty elk.
I think if you make it an elk, it loses haste.
It's true. It does.
Oh, no.
That's, yeah. It's hard because you're just looking at elk. You don't get to see the text anymore of your card. So I had to learn the hard way on some of those.
The thing I find most infuriating about Oko is that there's no elk token cards that I could find that let you say this card is an elk in a nice way. So I started with these, like, little scraps of paper that said elk on them. Then I migrated to like elephant tokens because they're 3/3. I just put them over the card. But that didn't quite feel right.
No, you need a little cutout of antlers that you could put on the cards.
Yeah, maybe what I should do is, Ari Lax had another funny tweet on the Oko subject where he said, I found a reasonable creature that can't be turned into an elk. It was Great Sable Stag, which is a 3/3 elk.
And is ironically pro-blue.
Can't elk me if I'm going to elk myself already.
So anyway, I really like the list. You guys are really good at playing these longer games. We make the decisions. They go long, and there's all these decision points. I don't like playing games like that, so I liked kind of setting everything up for the one key turn and just going for it. Certainly fit my playstyle better. I don't know if it's better or worse, but I would definitely tweak some of these numbers. I didn't need any of the border posts are an idea that Dan had that is very clever to turn your Fabro Elder into its full potential. But I never actually really liked them because I'm already playing for blue-red planeswalkers, which a normal Niv list is not. I never felt like I needed them. So I think I'd go up to one more Oko and maybe play another Icefang Quaddle just to have more stuff to turn into elk. Or copy with Saheeli Rai. One of the lines that's really important is being able to minus 2 your Saheeli Rai to basically get it to fully draw a card, either an Arkham's Astrolabe or Icefang Quaddle. That's a very common line of play.
It turns out that Saheeli Rai on Uptick mode is the worst 3 CMC Planeswalker ever printed.
That is 100% correct. It is so maddening. And multiple times I kept the card, then they like Field of Ruined me.
Yeah.
Stupid opponent.
2 quick shout-outs here. One is to a longtime listener of the podcast, Lawson Zandi, who got in touch with us on Twitter, said that he had been streaming Faber on Niv-Mizzet, kind of inspired by your 5-0, Damon. He said he had done like 20-some hours of streaming the lists over the weekend and had really good results. You can find that gameplay at twitch.tv/zanman1414. Second, on the subject of the Bring to Light Saheeli Felidar combo, there is a player who goes by the name Foreign Magra on Magic Online, who also hangs out in the Niv-Mizzet Discord. As far as I know, they are the only person who plays this deck. It is a Bring to Light Saheeli Kiki Felidar Deceiver Exarch deck that also has the singleton Niv-Mizzet for exactly the reasons that Dave was saying. Even though this particular build does not play very many Niv hits at all, maybe 12 tops, the card is just the best thing you can get in a lot of board states when you're not ready to go for a combo. You just want to get a giant guy, get a little bit of card advantage, and get some pressure. Foreign Magra has been playing this list for a long time. You can find a lot of their published results. They 5-0 all the time. They were saying in the Discord they had something like 4 5-0s in their last 6 leagues over the weekend, which is insane. So there might be a hole in the format where you can just get people with Saheeli Felidar right now. And I think this list is really designed to just go hard on that. We'll post all those lists if you're interested in 5 colors or up to 5 colors. Casting some Niv-Mizzets, that's still a good thing to do in Modern.
Excellent. So we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to talk about our card from last week, which was the Great Henge.
Welcome back. We're here to discuss our results from brewing with the card The Great Henge, which is one of the mythic rare legendary artifact cycles from Throne of Eldraine. Just as a reminder, it's 7 and 2 green for, again, a legendary artifact, and it costs X less to cast, where X is the greatest power among creatures you control. From there, it has tap, add 2 green, you gain 2 life. Whenever a non-token creature enters the battlefield under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on it and draw a card. The focal point of our discussion was A, how you get this card into play. It has a nice recommendation, namely get creatures with high power, but it's not always completely straightforward how to do that. And then B, how to really capitalize on its abilities to see if we could take this card, which is actually one of the more expensive Throne of Eldraine cards because I think it's commander playability, and see if we can make it do big things in Modern. So the first deck that we tried was this Sultai Hengevine list that Dan tried. Dan, how did that go?
The good news is that I went 4-1 with the deck, and it felt very powerful. But to maybe elaborate on that, the powerful parts of the deck are the following. Hedron Crab, Stitcher Supplier, Gravecrawler, Bloodghast, Vengevine, Prized Amalgam, Carrion Feeder. You get the picture. This is basically a Dredgevine, maybe Crabvine. Are they called Crabvine?
They are calling it Crabvine.
This is basically a Crabvine shell. The card that is best equipped to get the Great Henge into play is the card Rotting Registrar. This was Dave, one of your additions. 7/6 zombie dinosaur for 3 mana that you can also grab off the card Unearth. So if you happen to mill your Registrar, let's say off of a Hedron Crab, for just 1 mana you can have this giant 7/6. That's enough to cast the Great Henge for just 2 mana. Also, incidentally, provides a discard outlet. These Crabvine lists, one of the complaints some people have about them is that because they do not have access to Faithless Looting anymore, they really have no way to get a card from their hand to their graveyard. Let's say you have a Vengevine or a Prized Amalgam. You don't really want to spend the mana on that. Wouldn't it be nice if you could discard it? Well, it turns out Registrar can do that, while also just being absolutely huge and perhaps just a great card in Modern that we've been sleeping on a little bit. So that's the good news. The bad news is that the Great Henge just wasn't a thing. I think I drew it once, and I had the opportunity to cast it because I had a Registrar in play, but I needed my mana to do something much more relevant. I needed my mana to cast Gravecrawlers, and the Henge would not have made a difference. This deck is a good deck. I think Registrar plus Unearth is actually a very nice addition to the archetype. I think you should not play the Great Henge in this deck.
Well, I'm glad Rotting Registrar at least worked. It was kind of an idea that I was thinking of, because it's also another zombie for Gravecrawler. So it weirdly checked a lot of boxes there. We were kind of hoping last week, because it has 7 power naturally, that you know get the Great Henge in play, and then you'd play a land, and you'd get a 3/2 Gravecrawler or Bloodghast and draw a card. But
right, I had high hopes for that. One thing that was interesting was that often in the sideboard of games, because I'm anticipating a large amount of graveyard hate being sided in, I end up sideboarding into configuration that is a little more fair and doesn't rely on the graveyard. So I'm actually just trying to hard cast a Registrar. We bring in 3 Oko Thief of Crowns. And in that kind of configuration, I would leave the Henges in because, yeah, I want to draw cards. It still just didn't matter. It's not even the case that I was always siding them out. I left them in for the majority of my matches. I just couldn't get anything out of them.
Were the Okos really good out of the sideboard?
Yeah. Yeah, they were good. You know they were good.
Of course. So did they knock off cages and things like that? Were they just doing like the generate some 3/3s for your squad?
A little bit of everything. I made a Hedron Elk. I turned a Reality Smasher into a Elk Smasher. Elder Deep Fiend became Elk Deep Fiend. I actually got to play against a Spiring Spike, and I defeated him. Yeah, Okos are just always very good.
Did he not draw his Okos?
He did not, no. He kept a hand because I had a cage and didn't have enough other stuff. Registrars alone were just bigger than everything the Eldrazi deck had going for it.
Yeah, and honestly, mulling to an Elk is not going to necessarily beat a graveyard deck.
Mulligan to an Elk. Right, exactly, exactly. I don't have much more to say about this Hengevine list. Take out the Henges and you have a very interesting take on Rotting Registrar Crabvine.
And Crabvine normally does not play Registrar, is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
Not in main or board.
Right. So I think we can move along to the next shell. We had talked about something more in the black-green persist undying space. Dave, I know you've been interested in this kind of deck for a while.
Oh, yeah. So we played similar lists. Was that week 8? With the Yawgmoth Thranposition, and I had, 17 different combos built in there. This one was a little simpler because the thought is Great Henge has a second ability beyond the drawing a card, which is putting a +1/+1 counter on. So if you have a Great Henge in play, and you have a Kitchen Finks in play, and you have a Yawgmoth Thranposition in play, the theory is you just sack your Kitchen Finks, you wrath their entire board, you draw as many cards as you like, and you gain a life every time you do this. The deck actually felt great. I went 4-1, and I only lost to Classic Infinity because I drew like 7 straight lands. We have to be huge favorites against them with our sideboard. And the Great Henge did nothing. The entire league, I sided it out against every unfair deck, of course. They're way too fast. This deck is at heart a Oko deck, so one of the things I was trying to take advantage of was Oko turning Vigian Hydropon. So that, for the people who don't know, is 1, a green and a blue for a plant mutant, 0/0 graft, 5. And it can't attack or block.
Graft 5 means that it enters the battlefield with 5 +1/+1 counters, and then whenever another creature enters, you have the option to move one of those +1/+1 counters onto it.
So if you turn 2 Vigian Hydropon, turn 3 Oko, you get to attack them with an 8 power creature, which came up and was awesome. Also, if Vigian Hydropon is in play and you start sacking your Kitchen Finks to your Yawgmoth Thran Physician, you can graft onto the Finks. So it basically served as like a draw 5, give 5 -1/-1 counters spread out among all your opponent's creatures. And it's like a 1 of target in a deck with Neoform and Eldritch Evolution. It was actually absolutely insane. But yeah, I think I had originally thought it was just a way that you can play it on for 3 mana, and then Great Henge next turn only costs 4, so it should be right on curve. But Great Henge is just, I think the problem is just functionally win more a card. It's only playable if you have a creature with a lot of power, and if you have a creature with a lot of power, the thing you don't want to do is draw a bunch of cards. Instead, you want to like protect your creature with a lot of power or play to the board. So I think maybe there's just something fundamentally wrong with the strategy of Great Henge, but the deck itself was amazing. This is fundamentally an Oko deck, and it's got all these Undying and Persist combos built in. And so similar to what Dan is describing, often an opponent would lose to Persist Undying triggers in game 1, and then they would side in all this graveyard hate, and you just play Oko, and you just win the fair game because they're casting Rest in Peace, and you're casting Oko on turn 2. You're just so far ahead at that point, you can't lose.
This deck with 57 other cards and no Ace of Tutor for Oko is fundamentally an Oko deck. I love it.
They're all fundamentally an Oko deck. I think I texted Dan 10 days ago. I was like, we need to stop thinking about Oko as one of the best cards in Eldraine, and we should start thinking about it as one of the 8 to 10 best cards in Modern, period. I think my opinion has only gotten stronger since I sent that text.
Yeah, and honestly, you heard it here first. Buy your Vigian Hydropons now. They're only 14 cents a piece because they're a common, but who knows how high they could go. Maybe 15 cents.
Even before the spike.
But yeah, I'd be interested in exploring this deck further, just abandoning the Great Henge and some of the cards I was only playing because of Great Henge. Carrion Feeder, in theory, was a card that could get a bunch of power, and then you could Oko it, and then you could cast your Great Henge for cheap. That never came up, and I don't think you need Carrion Feeder at all in this deck. Same with Yorvo. It was just a bad Vigian Hydropon, if we're being honest with each other. He was okay, but I really wished he was a Vigian Hydropon every time I drew him. I didn't hate the 1 Rancor, though. In theory, Rancor is sort of like a quote-unquote ritual to get out your Great Henge, but it's actually just a fine card if you're putting it on Stranglerout Christ to force trades. Also, when you get into your like Oko wars where they're playing Elk and you're playing Elk, you're forcing each other to play Elk, as it were. This deck just wins all those because you have all these creatures with +1/+1 counters and a Rancor. Basically, you just can't lose when it gets to that point. So yeah, the deck is sweet. It was super fun to play. I think if you just abandon Great Henge, there's something here.
How often were you winning through combo lines versus mid-range beats lines?
I fully comboed once in what do I have? 9 match wins. So not that often. Is you just get all this value. Yawgmoth just buys you all this time, and then you iterate through a few of these. You can't go infinite, but you, whatever, sacrifice a young wolf, or sack a Sphinx, persistent back, gain 2 life. You get a couple iterations from your young wolf, etc. And that's just enough. Like, you just draw 3 or 4 cards there. You get your life back because you have the Sphinx. You've killed the key creatures. You've killed the Thalia or the whatever, the Goblin Electromancer. And then you just start Okoing all your crappy creatures. Your young wolf becomes a 3/3 with a +1/+1 counter on it. And you, like, win the game weirdly, weirdly quickly.
So, speaking of Stranglerroot Geist and young wolf, I did try one league with Bant Monkey Henge. Bant Monkey Form is one of the very first decks that we ever tried on this podcast back in episode 1. It is a Simic Evolve deck using the undying green creatures, but also the creatures with Evolve. Cloudfin Raptor, Experiment 1, sometimes Pelt Collector. We had postulated back in our first episode that Neoform was a massive upgrade to the deck, which proved to be very true. We had a lot of success with this deck. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to give Great Henge another chance. This Monkey Form deck, I know it's a good deck. It's a lot of fun. It can make giant Evolve creatures. It can make giant Voice of Resurgence tokens. So it's certainly capable of producing a large enough creature to cast Great Henge. So I took that through a league. I added a couple of Great Henges. Added some Okos because it is a Simic deck. And you can guess how it went. The matches were all close. I think went 2 and 3, but they were very close losses. Deck was great, and the Henge was just not relevant. It was definitely worse than Evolutionary Leap for this style of deck. That ended up being another swing and a miss in terms of trying to find a deck that would naturally want the Henge. The games were just decided too quickly in the early turns. Got paired against combo decks and more unfair decks that were just trying to... There were other battles to fight, and there was just no place for the Henge. That being said, one of the shells that I thought might be a more natural home was more of like a dedicated Stompy shell, mono-green Stompy. Damon, you took a dive into that archetype. Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah. We joked about this deck being cool because your leagues take about 30 minutes each, and that was pretty true, but I have to say it was kind of a miserable 30 minutes. This was this green Stompy list featuring 4 Hierarchs, and from there the cards get worse. 4 Experiment 1, 4 Pelt Collector, 4 Avatar of the Resolute, 4 Stranglerroot Geist, Barkhide Trolls, Hex Drinkers, Steel Leaf Champions, Yorvos, 4 Aspect of Hydra, which is 1 green to pump up a dude by +X/+X, where X is your devotion to green, which can occasionally be quite large. 2 Great Henge and 21 lands surrounded out. To some extent, the problems were like based off matchups. First, I played against Twiddle Storm, and I got killed on turn 4 and turn 3. This deck is just this mono green list. You can mold to Damping Sphere, and that's really your only hope. I also got crushed by a white green value deck that just had Knight of the Reliquaries and Shalai's that were just bigger than my dudes. Giver of Runes is particularly unpleasant to play against when you're a mono green deck with no removal and all your cards are one color. That was kind of a nightmare. They just had Path to clean up some cards. And then Tron was also a nightmare. It turns out if they ever get an Oblivion Stone anywhere in their draw, you really can't win that game. I was about to drop, but I decided to play 2 more. I actually beat Blue-Black Fairies and Blue-White Spirits, where the deck was a little bit more at home. Had some good Stompy draws. But I don't know. I mean, Pelt Collector always disappoints us. They come off the top at the wrong time. I did manage to sneak the Great Henge to play a few times off of, for example, Noble Hierarch. Scale up a Noble Hierarch, attack, and then it becomes a 7 power dude.
Oh, nice.
Great Henge comes down for green, green. It turns out that I still lost that game. I just didn't draw creatures. You need to really have a lot of things go right to get the Great Henge into play. And usually getting all those things to go right involves not having things to do after it comes into play.
Right.
Once against Blue-Black Fairies, yeah, that's where I found this line. And then I drew 3 lands in a row and died. All I got to do with the Great Henge was at the end of their turn, tap for 2 green, gain 2 life, and then have to press through the "are you sure you want to empty your mana pool?" And I was like, oh, no, my gosh. Yes, I'm sure.
I've done that a few times myself.
It's one of those decks where if things go well and your draws are good, you win some titles. It can really steal some games in a hurry, but I don't know if I want to return to the Great Henge.
How sweet is scale up with Yorvo, by the way?
That never occurred for me, but that does look sweet. Aspect of Hydra was actually pretty cool. We have a lot of times where I start looking at your green pips and counting, and you try not to start grinning. You're like, man, this guy's going to get +9/+9. How can they block? But I actually managed to screw it up a few times, even regardless, where I think I would have had lethal if I just didn't get too clever.
How do you screw up an aspect of Hydra?
The leak happened so quickly, it was all kind of a blur to me. I think I, for whatever reason, I was like, I can win this game no matter what. And so then I pumped the creature that a Shalai was blocking, and then Shalai soaked up one extra point of toughness. And so even though I cleared the Shalai, they beat me from one life. Several things went wrong to make my calculations fall off, but they did in fact not go right. And it was probably pilot error.
Another failed hinge.
So if you hierarch into Yorvo and then scale up aspect of Hydra and Rancor, what is that? 18 damage? 19 damage?
Say that again?
Turn 1, Noble Hierarch. Turn 2, Yorvo. Turn 3, you Rancor it.
Uh-huh.
You scale up, and then you cast Aspect of Hydra, and then attack with an Exalted trigger. Is that 18?
Oh, 12, 13, +5. Yeah, it sounds like 18. Yeah.
All right, that's almost a thing.
Unfortunately, your draw did not have any of those cards. Your draw had Treetop Village, a Forest, Great Henge, and 3 Pelt Collectors.
And a Bark-Eyed Droll.
I hate Pelt Collector.
Yeah.
That card and Bloodbraid Elf are my two least favorite magic cards.
Although if you Bloodbraid Elf into Pelt Collector, it triggers.
Would you believe that Pelt Collectors won a Pro Tour or a Mythic Championship? I can't believe it.
Hopefully they can ban it in time.
I just cannot believe it.
Shout out to Javier Dominguez.
If you can win a Pelt Collector, that guy can win with anything.
Yeah. So similarly to the Gruul beatdowns that won the, that's not a Pro Tour, but, you know, the sad remains of what was the Pro Tour. Another avenue we tried was to maybe play lists that use temporary pump spells to get our creatures big. So I proposed a list that had the Prowess creatures combined with Sir Farron, the Henge Hammer. So we're casting his favorite tool, his own hammer. And then spells that kind of combine to power up. So Scale Up is a card that we talked about. If you have like Dreadheart Arcanist, you get to cast it on both your Arcanist and your Swift Spear. A Scale Up on any of your Prowess creatures brings their power just to 7. And then the deck has Become Immense, Mutagenic Growth, and things like that to try to get temporarily up to a high enough power to cast the Henge. I went 2 and 3 with that list. I played a bunch of super removal heavy lists, like a Sultai list that must be very close to that, the one we discussed last week that Sam Black played. So it had 3 Mystic Sanctuaries, probably a bunch of removal. I played a Grixis Death Shadow list that killed all my creatures. And I played a Grixis Control list that also relentlessly killed all my creatures. The card that was really haunting is Drown in the Lock. So normally against fast decks like mine, control decks have to take out their counter spells because they're so slow. So I brought in, I can't think of the card, but it, you guys will tell me, of course.
Shaper Sanctuary.
Shaper Sanctuary, and then it just fucking sucked. They let it resolve, and they just were able to counter all my spells because they got to keep in their 2-mana Terminate that also somehow was split card counterspell.
Oh, wow. So instead of terminating your creature and then you draw a card, they just counter the creature?
Yes. And they did it over and over again until eventually they took mercy on me and engineered explosives away my Shaper Sanctuary that basically had no text. So they pretended it was at least worth a card.
I have to say, you left your Veil of Summers at home.
I had 2 Veil of Summers in the list. And because you just can't mulligan like that, you know, in an aggro deck to, if you have a Shaper Sanctuary and like 2 creatures, the thought process is that that'll be good enough.
Oh, yeah.
It was frustrating to play against these removal-heavy decks, and they're always going to be well-positioned against, you know, lists that are functionally playing Jekyll Pup-esque creatures. I never got to cast a Great Henge, and the one game I could have, I just killed the opponent instead. Seemed like a better line. But I recommended to Dan that I think the list is really cool, and the interaction between Dreadheart Arcanist and Sir Farron is, like, legit. So I recommended he try it with some tweaks and to abandon the Great Henge. So, Dan, you want to talk about your experiences with that?
Yeah, the screenshots that you had sent me where you had both Arcanist and Sir Farron in play, they just look so sweet. We talked about how those two combined with, for example, a Reckless Charge to give one of them haste ends up producing something like 17 damage or something on the third turn.
Yes.
Sir Farron essentially is a double strike creature where if you stack your triggers correctly, you'll get this pingback effect where you end up doubling and then quadrupling your pump spell. So based on what we talked about last week and Dave's first league result, I felt like this deck just needs more creatures. I wanted to feel happy about Atarka's Command, so I increased the creature count to have 12 one drops, so I added Wild and Cattle and the appropriate Shocklands. I went up to a full 4 copies of Sir Farron, because I just really wanted to do that line with the Reckless Charge. And then 2 Gruul Spellbreaker. This is a card we played a lot of in Kiora decks, but in this build, I thought it might be important to just have a guy with Trample and Hexproof, so that if things get ugly and I'm only able to resolve one creature, the Spellbreaker, at least, because it has Trample and Hexproof, if you're pointing pump spells at it, it's going to get through. I played one league with this. I went 4-1. I gotta say, winning the die roll is a hell of a drug. Just seeing that notification pop up, like, I get to go first. I get to go first with this deck. That's crazy. It's like cheating. It just so happened that I got paired against 3 red decks.
2 burn and 1 red prowess.
Going first was the key to those matchups. But I also beat Amulet, where the speed of the deck was on display nicely.
I also beat an Is It Pyromancer deck, where they tried to gum up the ground with little tokens. They tried to trick me with Force and Negations on my turn to chump block my guys, but Spellbreaker came through. Just trampled over everything. It turns out that that deck cannot kill a 4-4 trample outside of combat, and I had plenty of pump spells to make sure that didn't happen.
Yeah, that's a Mythic Champion Gruul Spellbreaker.
Mythic Champion. Yeah. We were playing with a lot of championship caliber cards this week. Pellet Collectors, Gruul Spellbreaker.
Could you squeeze in a Mythic Champion Embercleave in here?
Oh, gosh.
Is that insane?
I would not. No, I don't think I would play that here. Would you?
As like a one-off, maybe. I mean, if you think you have enough creatures to make it cost 3 or less, I feel like you could maybe support it with a mana base. With only 19 lands, so that might still be dicey. I mean, the card is actually staggeringly powerful when it connects, as we saw during the Mythic Championship.
My instinct would be no. I mean, you just need so many things to be going right for it to be good in a list like this. I think it's a card we should maybe consider exploring in Modern, though. I think it has legitimate applications.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that you don't need that much to be going right to make it go nuts. There's a lot better removal at instant speed in Modern than there is in Standard, of course. But it puts out so much damage when it's on a big creature. It loves Rotting Regisaur. This deck doesn't have that, but it does in fact have Become Immense and some pump spells. Something to think about.
So I think the lesson we learned is that in none of these lists, even the ones that found some success, was the Great Henge a key cog. Often it rotted in your hand or got discarded to Liliana the Veil or whatever. So the takeaway I had was that the requirement to have a 7-power creature is a very real one. And if you have a 7-power creature, you should probably just kill your opponent. You shouldn't be farting around with trying to draw a couple extra cards. Did you guys have anything extra beyond that observation?
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I think the decks that we were playing were not really equipped to take advantage of the Great Henge in the sense that they were all more or less aggressive decks. None of them were built to play a longer game, and the Great Henge, if it does anything, it probably shines best in a nice leisurely game of Commander.
Yeah.
A game that lasts many turns where you're triggering it repeatedly, gaining life, making mana. I think that because these decks we were building were mostly green or black creature-based, they just had to race all the time. I found myself always having to race, or in a post-Cyborg game, maybe mulligan to a hate card. Had nothing to do with the Henge. So I think if I really like needed to, if someone said, hey, you have to build an actual Great Henge deck and win a tournament tomorrow, I would just maybe start from scratch, build a deck that is designed to go into the long game with something like Hand Disruption, Thoughtseize Inquisition, that kind of thing. I think Registrar was actually a good instinct. It would need to still be a creature-heavy deck, So I'm thinking maybe you'd have Registeuras, you'd have Tarmogoyfs, and possibly the card Growth Chamber Guardian, kind of like a green Squadron Hawk, if you squint. The theory is that a Growth Chamber Guardian is worth several triggers of Great Henge. Cards like that can only really shine if the rest of your deck creates space for them to do their thing. The modern format is naturally hostile to that. The average opponent is not going to let you just screw around with playing medium-sized creatures and making them bigger.
Yeah.
So that's probably where I would start if I really had to try to do it again.
Well, you can also just go to your faithful tournament-winning deck of Bolas of Citadel and just toss a Great Henge in there.
With a Citadel out, you can play the Great Henge for zero mana.
Yeah, then gain 2 life immediately.
Exactly.
What could go wrong? Gosh, you could even get a March of the Machines in there first, and then your Bolas of Citadel is a 6/6, and your Great Henge is a 9/9.
Well, we're doing it now.
So I think we've said all we need to say about the Great Henge. If anyone else out there has an idea maybe we didn't explore, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Interesting deck building exercise, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. We found decks that were successful. They were not successful because of the Great Henge. So in that sense, maybe we won the war, but not the battle or whatever. So yeah, we'll wrap that up and we'll take a quick break. And then when we come back, we will talk about our task for this week, which is not about a specific card, but is about a new format, which is Pioneer. We'll take a deep dive into some of the constraints and some of the possibilities in the new Pioneer format. Hi guys, so we're going to do something a little different this week. With the introduction of Pioneer, I'm going to do a deep dive into that format, and we're going to break it out into a second cast. There's so much stuff to cover, the mana bases, the threats, the possible strategies, sort of how we're feeling about it. We're going to release that on a different day, and then we'd like feedback from you guys, the listeners. Would you like us to keep pursuing Modern primarily, or are you interested in kind of digging into the Pioneer format, or maybe a mixture of both? Please let us know.
Absolutely. We posted this question on our Twitter feed the morning of the announcement, and it seemed clear that there was a good amount of interest in both formats, but I know that is only a small fraction of our listener base that follows us on Twitter, so wherever you are, we want to hear from you. This is a really exciting time for a brewer with the birth of a brand new competitive format, but it is also a confusing time for players like us who love Modern. Pioneer has a lot of the qualities that we really value in Modern. There's so much room to explore, but it is also completely different from Modern in many other respects, missing a lot of things that we find both comforting and terrifying about the Modern format. The one thing we know for sure is that we have no plans to abandon Modern. We love Modern, and we are always excited to keep brewing and exploring in it and sharing that with all of you. As for Pioneer, we're going to do the only thing we really can do, which is follow our hearts, follow our instincts, so that we can keep producing content that we believe in and that we're passionate about. We're going to play it by ear and also take into consideration what we hear from all of you.
We're here to make you guys happy, and if you're not interested in Pioneer, if you really do think of us as a Modern podcast, or maybe if you're just more interested in brewing, and the most fertile place to brew right now is obviously this brand new format, that's feedback we want to hear too. So please let us know in the comments. Thanks.
That'll do it for this edition of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. All of the deck lists from today's show are linked in the show notes, which you can find in your podcast player or at faithlessbrewing.podbean.com. If you would like to support Faithless Brewing, you can now do so at our Patreon page. You can find it at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. All patrons will get access to our Discord channel, as well as bonus content and lots of other cool rewards. Whether you become a patron or not, we want to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. Email us, faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or find us on Reddit at r/modernmagic and r/pioneermtg. We rely on brewers like you to help us improve the show and bring you better content. So give us a follow, tell a friend, and we will see you next week.